funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How satisfied are you with the languages you speak? Do they delight and fascinate you or simply get the job done? Either way, do you think that you might be able to come up with something better? Given the way natural languages evolve over centuries, it seems almost impossible that anybody could create a brand new one in a single lifetime. But that hasn't stopped people from trying. In fact, linguists have identified around 900 constructed languages invented over as many years, starting with the creation of polymath German nun Hildegard von Bingen. So what kind of person sets out to create new systems of communication? Linguist and cognitive neuroscientist Erica Okrent wondered the same thing. She shares what she learned in her new book, In the Land of Invented Languages, Esperanto Rock Stars, Klingon Poets, Logland Lovers, and the Mad Dreamers Who Tried to Build a Perfect Language. Erica, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What sort of person invents a language?
It's been done for different reasons through history, but the main reason that's happened for 100 years is people have found something that they're dissatisfied with language. So they take a look at it and think, it's too hard for us to put our thoughts into words, or there's too many irregularities, there's too much ambiguity. Why can't we do something about this, create a better language? It's people who have grand plans for re-engineering the way we communicate.
Yeah, grand plans is a great word because it does seem to take a certain amount of moxie to think that you have the ability to do this.
Yes, and linguists have generally looked on this practice with much irritation, because when you study a subject, you know how difficult it is to describe the thing you're studying. And if you study language long enough, you realize how much there is we don't know about the way it works and the truth behind it. So for someone to come along and say, hey, I'm going to build a better one, it's kind of an insult to people who study language deeply.
And you write about going into the section of the linguistics library that is sort of embarrassing to be seen poking your nose around.
Yeah, the artificial languages are generally found at the very end of the language section, and they're usually on pretty dusty shelves.
So let's talk about Hildegard von Bingen, this cloistered German nun. She might be characterized as the inventor of language invention.
Yes, well, her language is the first one that we have documentation for, but I can almost guarantee that it's been going on long before her, and as long as people have been using language and thinking about language. She created a large vocabulary for things in the natural world and things in her world, and it's unclear what the purpose was. Some think it might have been a secret language she used with her nuns. Others think it was a sort of divine inspiration, speaking in tongues. She clearly had a feeling for what she thought a language should sound like and look like, and had to get it down on paper. So now it's viewed as sort of an artistic creation. She was an artist and a musician and various other things, and also a language creator.
And she created not only an oral language, but also some symbols to represent this language.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very often people who engage in language invention create invented scripts and entire invented cultures in which to fit their languages, which is what the current day language inventors are more involved in, not so much trying to improve or cure natural language, but simply to create an aesthetically pleasing language, aesthetically pleasing to them, and then they often create a whole world around it in which to have that language make sense.
What's so remarkable, Erica, is that so many of these people who have done these things that seem to make sense to them and from their perspective would make sense to everyone, these things are often still really esoteric and hard to imagine naturally.
Yes. The purposes of making language more clearer or able to express truths often result in languages that are almost impossible to use.
Another really fascinating character in the book, I think, is John Wilkins, who essentially believed that words should be more functional than they are right now.
Yeah, he was a 17th century man of science, and the time when he was working and helping to found the Royal Society, Latin was on its way out as a lingua franca, and mathematics or mathematical notation was being developed, and people were making great discoveries through the use of this notation, which was universal in a sense. It could be understood without understanding the spoken language. And people started to think, hey, maybe we could make a math for everything, for all concepts in the universe. And he set out to create a map of the universe that could be the basis for such a language. He worked for years on it and then lost it in the Great Fire of London, had to do it all over again, but pushed it through to completion. Nobody speaks it today.
It seems that there has to be almost a critical mass because, you know, who's going to learn it if only this one other person speaks it? And so you have to sort of evangelize for what you create.
Yeah, you could have the most beautiful, wonderful, perfect language, but if you have nobody to speak it with, it's not going to get spoken. And this is what the next era of language inventors realized. You could, instead of focusing on a perfectly rational language, make a pretty rational language, but that was usable. And this is what the language inventors of the 19th century worked on. They took roots from various languages, from German, French, English, and mixed them together and created these hybrid languages, but with totally regular endings, regular spellings, and the most successful one of these was Esperanto, because the creator focused not so much on the details of the language, but on getting a community started and getting people to use it. And indeed they did, and they still do today. There are even some native speakers of Esperanto.
It's really interesting, Esperanto, because there was kind of a utopian ideal that formed the basis for this. The inventor lived in what amounted to a modern-day Babel in Poland. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the inventor, Ludwig Zamenhof, was a sensitive, mild-mannered person who saw around him all this nationalism and strife of the mid-19th century. And there were Yiddish speakers, Russian speakers, Polish speakers, all together, all not getting along with each other. And he started to think that what was needed to cure this disease of language of causing nationalism was to create a second neutral language where everyone could learn a second language and meet on that plane as equals instead of the person who spoke Russian having power over the person who spoke Polish. So the idea was a universal second language that would bring peace to the world, allow us to communicate without these power imbalances. The people who picked up Esperanto were attracted to that ideal, sometimes even more so than the language itself. So he was able to build a community based on like-minded people who were concerned about the same problems, and they picked Esperanto not necessarily because it was the best language or the most regular one or the easiest to pronounce, but because there were a community of like-minded people who also ascribed to those ideals, and they got together, they put on plays, they made songs, they made poetry, and made a culture, a little bit self-consciously at the beginning, but over time, that self-consciously created culture became a real one.
What does Esperanto sound like when it's spoken?
It sounds like, mi parolas Esperanton, ĉu vi parolas Esperanton? Sort of, if you know a couple European languages, you can fake it pretty well, and you can pick up the meaning.
Of course, all that passion that people had for the ideals behind this led to what you call the Great Esperanto Schism. Can you talk about what divided people who spoke and believed in the language?
Well, once you start inventing a language and tinkering with language, it's hard to stop. So it was presented as, oh, here's this nice, regular, easy-to-learn language, and then others take a look at it and said, well, there's this ending isn't quite so easy to learn, and there aren't quite enough Latin roots. There's too many weird Germanic roots. Let's make it easier, and started fiddling with it, and hundreds of Esperanto-type languages came out after Esperanto, and one of them was created by the sort of prestige scientists and linguists who were interested in the question, they created a better Esperanto called Ido and decided to back that one and drew off most of the prestigious-minded language people. But Ido ended up not going very far because by taking away from Esperanto, the fervent true believers became even more attached to their beloved language, and Esperanto won out in the end.
Well, you get the sense that no matter what and no matter how much we might wish it to be so, you just cannot divide language from culture.
No, and you need to, as you said, you need to have someone to speak with, so you need to have something to talk about, so language has to be situated in a culture of people who have something to talk about with each other.
How many people speak Esperanto right now?
The estimates vary. It's hard to know. I would say there's at least 50,000, although estimates go as high as 2 million. But there's probably a lot of people in that estimate who have a, you know, not very high level of Esperanto. But I have seen it spoken quite fluently. And in a way that I didn't expect to see it when I went out to these Esperanto conferences looking to see what was really going on there.
Yeah, you went to one in, of all places, Havana, Cuba. What sort of people showed up?
There were people from all over the world, and it was interesting there because the Esperantists in Cuba really did have a little more of a contact with the outside world than they might have otherwise had. There was a sort of practical function for Esperanto for them. They had pen pals and people in other countries that they could practice Esperanto and get information from. But it was, people think of Esperanto as this sort of insult to language because it wants to make us all the same and it wants to take away the personality from language and make a neutral one. But what I found there was a whole lot of personality, I got to say.
And people are writing songs and translating songs and having entire concerts in this language.
Yes, and doing it rather purposefully. So you can swear really well in Esperanto. You can do, you know, everything you need to do in order to function as a human communicator.
Yeah, you tried to, and we won't use the word, but you tried to find ways to swear in John Wilkins' language and had a really hard time with that.
Yes, well, of course, I had this massive chart of all the concepts in the universe, and I wanted to look something up in the dictionary. And, you know, what do we do when we're confronted with a dictionary? We try to look up, a four-letter word, and that's what I did and ended up with. I found it, and it came out in his chart of concepts as a motion of purgation moving downward from the guts. That's how you say that in Wilkins' language.
And it became ultimately just not very titillating by the time you had done all this research.
No, it was exhausting just to find that one word, the payoff. The payoff was nice, but not enough payoff to make it worth it to really try to speak this language.
Erica Okrent is my guest. She's a linguist and cognitive neuroscientist. Her new book is called In the Land of Invented Languages, Esperanto Rock Stars, Klingon Poets, Logland Lovers, and the Mad Dreamers Who Tried to Build a Perfect Language.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is linguist Erica Okrent. Her new book is called In the Land of Invented Languages, Esperanto Rockstars, Klingon Poets, Logland Lovers, and the Mad Dreamers Who Tried to Build a Perfect Language. I have to tell you, Erica, this is a book full of colorful characters, but one of the strangest is this guy named Charles Bliss. Who was he, and what did he intend for his language, Bliss Symbolics?
Well, Charles Bliss had been a refugee from Nazi Germany in Shanghai, which is one of the only places where you could go after other countries stopped accepting refugees. And there he became entranced with Chinese characters he saw everywhere. And he became convinced that if we had a language based on pictographic principles, a language of symbols, then people wouldn't be able to abuse us with words, manipulate us with propaganda, as they had done in his homeland. And so he started to construct a language of symbols, pictorial symbols, which could be combined into more complex concepts, and worked hard all his life, sending his massive book out to all the universities in the world, all the governments in the world, trying to get attention and support. And he was ignored consistently until a school for children with cerebral palsy in Canada chanced upon a system and decided to start using it to help kids who couldn't speak see, so they could point to the symbols to communicate, and then they would use this as a bridge into reading and to English. And he was overjoyed when they paid attention to him, and there was articles about him. He was in Time magazine. But pretty soon he began to interfere in their program, believing that they weren't using it correctly. He wanted it to be this universal, logical language of perfect thought, and they were using it as a practical tool to get to English. And he started writing letters against them and threatening lawsuits. He had fought so hard for recognition all his life, and then once he got it, he destroyed it by interfering, and eventually ended with a legal settlement and him producing his own version of their books, which never went anywhere, and he really impeded the spread of this as any kind of therapeutic tool.
What are the sort of legal options for someone who invents a language? Can you patent the entire thing?
Well, it's unclear. It's never been tested in court, so we don't know if you can own a language. But there was a language called Logland over which the inventor tried to assert ownership. And the way he did this was by saying it was copyrighted. And so he did this because the Logland was invented to be a logical language, which you could speak in logic, and this would supposedly make you think more logically. The inventor, James Cook Brown, got into disagreements with some of his followers who wanted to do things that he didn't agree with in the language, and they set out, and once he asserted copyright over it, they decided to make up all their own words but use the same grammar. And it went all the way to district court, over the question of whether he had a trademark on this language, and the court decided against him. But it didn't really resolve the question of what exactly you can own in a language, because there is a language now, Klingon, the Star Trek universe, which is essentially owned by Paramount, but that ownership, again, has never been tested in court, so we don't really know.
Yeah, I love the story of Klingon, because this was essentially invented by a linguist for hire.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a mercenary linguist, if you will. Mark Okrand was hired to create Klingon for the third Star Trek movie. There had been a little bit of Klingon in the first one, so he had to go back and use that in his language. And as he was developing enough of a language in order to be used for the dialogue that they needed, he had to keep track of it. So he drew paradigms and charts, and he ended up with a very complex, grammatically complex language based on interesting features of exotic languages that really exist in the world. And the fans have picked up on it and translated Hamlet into it, and has a life of its own now.
And you are a certified speaker of Klingon.
Yes, I went to a Klingon conference thinking I would observe and take some notes and find out what was really going on there. But then I found out they had this language certification exam, and I got swept up in the challenge of it and ended up passing the first one. There are three, so I'm a very low-level Klingon speaker, but I'm proud of that.
It's not an easy language to learn.
No, it's very complex and unlike very unlike English or European languages, but it has a lot of interesting linguistic features cribbed from the natural languages of the world.
Do you have a favorite Klingon sentence?
Well, I can say, "Tach par tach be, tach mutlervam vekelnish," and that's the famous soliloquy from Hamlet.
Huh.
To be or not to be, or in Klingon, to continue or not to continue. There's no verb for to be in Klingon. That was a problem.
Erica Okrent is my guest. We're talking about her book, In the Land of Invented Languages. Let's go first to Jeff in Plano. Hey, Jeff.
Hello. It's a wonderful program. Thank you very much. I hope you can hear me. I didn't pick up the Klingon very well over my phone, so I know you can't be hearing me well. But I just wanted to talk about Esperanto and the concept of the irregular verb. Right now I've got 2 4-year-old daughters, and they're, of course, naturally trying to learn the English language. And they're talking about sitted down. I sitted down, and I have to tell them, no, you sat down. And they want to know why. Why is it not sitted down, and I can't explain it? Yet I know that in something like Esperanto, that is deliberately gone for a wonderful reason. The case is for most hybrid or made-up languages?
Yeah, do they get rid of the irregular things, Erica?
Most of them do. The ones designed to improve upon languages, of course, get rid of irregularities as soon as they can. The ones created for artistic purposes and languages like Klingon love the little twists and messiness and irregularities in language and rather put them in there in order to make them seem more natural. What your kids are doing is noticing that there's a system there and then trying to apply the system and then being thwarted in that and saying, well, you don't apply the system quite that regularly. And when you're asked why, the only answer is, well, that's just the way we do it. That's how irregularities, that's the only way they can be explained in natural language.
And my understanding is, in a 4-year-old, it's not a bad sign. It means that they're getting most of it.
Yeah, it means that they can recognize that there's a system there, and they're doing, you know, what any scientist would do and try to apply that system. But no natural languages are messy, and they don't let us. They thwart us at every turn when we're trying to make predictions about how they should and might work.
I have to imagine, as a linguist, you're also somewhat drawn to the messiness of language. Was that sort of a disconnect for you in trying to really embrace these ones that had been created to fix the language?
Yeah, I mean, I would say going on this journey through invented languages and their history has made me really appreciate the messiness of language and what it lets us do. You know, if we had a perfect language, it would be very difficult for us to say the things that we say and to use language the way we use it. We don't need to necessarily know what we're going to say before we start talking. We can discover what our ideas are as we talk. We can just talk just to talk. I can do it for social reasons, to show solidarity, to give comfort, and the language and the messiness, the sloppiness of the language allows us to do things with it that go beyond just transmitting information in a reliable way.
Let's go next to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Go ahead, please.
Yes, I was just, very intrigued and more or less disappointed to find out when I started looking into sign language to find out that here was a chance to make a pure language based not on spoken word, but sign, and then to find out there are different dialects, mm-hmm. and the one that is used most commonly in America is not the quote-unquote universal sign language.
No, yeah. Contrary to what most people assume, sign language is not an invented language in the sense that I mean is consciously constructed. Sign languages grew up naturally out of communities of deaf people, and there's different sign languages in different countries. They're not mutually intelligible. But there was an invented sign language called Gestuno, which was put together by the World Federation of the Deaf in the 70s as a way to have a, you know, an international, the Esperanto sign language, I guess you'd say, for use at their the Deaf Olympics and Deaf gatherings. But it ended up being a big failure. So not even with sign language can you build a universal sign language. It just, sign languages don't work that way, and they work like natural languages. They are natural languages.
Yeah, you write about the fact that a lot of people who don't speak any kind of sign language assume that all of the signs are based on motions that are natural or concepts that we could understand in sort of a visual way. But in fact, people in these communities just sort of agree that something means something and then move on from there.
Yeah, you see someone, oh, here's the sign for lion, and it looks like a lion's mane, and you think, oh, yeah, of course that's a sign for lion. But when you know the sign and you know the meaning, it's easy to say that. But who's to say the same sign doesn't mean, you know, hairdo or something equally as iconically related to it? So this idea that pictorialism or iconicity is a good basis for a universal concept transmission it doesn't work. We have to interpret things. We have to interpret pictures or icons. And they don't just mean in a natural way without that level of interpretation.
And when missionaries, I guess Jesuits, first went into Asia, they looked at Asian characters and thought perhaps that although the languages were different, the spoken languages, that the written languages were universal there.
Yeah, and Bliss's language was based on that idea, but Chinese characters, actually, they aren't a universal system, and they aren't even mutually intelligible between people who speak different dialects of Chinese. Chinese writing represents spoken language, not in the way that alphabetic writing does, and it's a much more complicated relationship, but Chinese symbols are not pictures of things, and they're not direct lines to concepts. They represent words, a Japanese speaker can't look at a Chinese newspaper and understand everything.
Erica Okrent is my guest. Her book is called In the Land of Invented Languages. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Terry in Fort Worth. Hey, Terry.
Hi, thank you. This is a thoroughly fascinating topic.
Oh, I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Okay, thank you. This is pretty far out on the edge of the spectrum of what you're talking about, but are you familiar with Edgar Rice Burroughs and the pretty extensive vocabulary and syntax he came up with for a number of his Tarzan stories?
For the Tarzan stories?
Yes, he had an entire language for the great apes that was the language of the animals, and he also had a number of novels that had Australopithecine characters Tarzan interacted with, and they had an entire language of their own.
No, I'm not familiar with it, but I know there's a long tradition of language invention in fiction. If you create a world, a fictional world, you often want to create a language to go with it, and there is lots of examples of that. But yeah, I didn't know about that one.
We'll move on now and talk with Norma in Dallas. Hey, Norma.
Hi, Erica. I had a question, speaking of fictional languages, about the languages of J.R.R. Tolkien, if you had researched them, and what interesting things you might have found or thought about it.
Well, the languages that Tolkien created were done for fictional purposes. It was more the opposite way around. He was fascinated by language, created this whole family of languages with historical derivation from one to the next, and then created his stories in order to put those languages somewhere, to give them a place to live, a place where they would make sense. His creation, if you look at them as a historical linguist, they make complete sense. You can look at them as if they were real languages with a real history and figure out what the sound changes were in the history and figure out the relationships between the languages. And yes, this was a massive creative project that fits in with the more modern day idea of language creation as art for its art's sake. And he was the premier artist within that tradition.
when we spoke earlier about the language that, that Burroughs created for the great apes, it reminded me of a language that you mentioned in the book called, is it Dry Talk? Is that how you pronounce it?
Dry Talk.
Dry Talk. Yeah. And this is a language based on chipmunk sounds.
Yeah, well, the sort of creative challenge of it was, could you build a language with only the kinds of sounds that a chipmunk makes, so no vocal cord vibration, just stuff you sounds that you make with the air in your mouth. So it's a language built out of sounds like clicks and hisses and pops, and there's a system to it, and you can make you can do a lot without vibrating your vocal cords in a language. That's the experiment and the challenge and what the sort of language artist wanted to try to overcome with his creation.
Yeah, people come together and they have these conferences. What do they talk about at is it constructed language conferences?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I attended one Conlang conference, and the level of discussion was extremely technical there. People who get seriously into creating their own languages have to know an awful lot about natural languages, because it's very easy to come up with an idea and say, hey, wouldn't it be weird if we had a language where, negation was expressed this way? And then you can always find a natural language that actually does it that way. So the more you know about the strange and wonderful things that natural languages can do, the more likely you are to come up with a truly original idea or a challenging idea for language creation. And I was very impressed with the level of technical knowledge that these Conlangers had.
Erica Okrent is my guest. She's a linguist and cognitive neuroscientist. Her book is called In the Land of Invented Languages, Esperanto Rockstars, Klingon Poets, Logland Lovers, and the Mad Dreamers Who Tried to Build a Perfect Language.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1, I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is linguist Erica Okrent. Her book is called In the Land of Invented Languages. Let's go next to Alberto in Dallas. Hey, Alberto.
Hello.
Go ahead, please.
Yes, I was hoping if your guest could comment on Klingon in particular, perhaps, or just the invented language in general, as to the creation or the denotative or connotative of how the process of creating both the vulgarity or profanity, that is, and on the other end, love and passion. How is that worked through and creatively processed there? And then I'll listen to off my phone.
Thanks for your call. I guess Klingon really was something that the person who invented it thought a lot about their culture, their supposed culture as he was creating
this. I mean, it's the artistic challenge with Klingon was to make a language that you would say, yep, that sounds like what Klingons would speak. And so it involved not just working out a sort of rough-sounding phonology and a complicated grammar, but also a context of what kind of vocabulary would they have, what kind of things would they say. And, of course, Klingons, as this sort of rough, crude, violent warrior race, have, you know, a wide array of vulgarity and cursing and types of things to choose from. The maybe the worst one you could use would be chab shoshle kuch, which means your mother has a smooth forehead. Be careful how you use that one.
and when you went to this conference, you definitely found people were not only, they were aware that everybody thought they were weird for being really into this, but they didn't care.
Yeah, and I was impressed with the way that they didn't care. You know, they wanted to do this, and they suffer a lot for it. People make fun of them constantly, but you know, they don't care. It's very interesting. It's a It's a fun challenge, and they know that they are doing something extremely difficult and sophisticated, and if nobody else can recognize that, well, then that's everyone else's problem.
On the other hand, you couldn't quite bring yourself even to get the hotel discount to say that you were with this group in order to get the, like, the convention rate.
Yeah, I had a hard time, you know, overcoming. I guess I'm a weaker person. I care what others think of me.
Very un-Klingon-like.
Yes.
Let's go next to McKinney, where we'll speak with Edward. Hi, Edward.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Big fan of your show. Hey, I was just wanting to mention Steven Spielberg actually had made up his own language in an animated TV series called The Animaniacs. There's these little creatures that ran around, and I think they talked a combination between French, Spanish, and maybe some German in there.
So it was actually a whole language, or it was just when they would have to speak, there would be something that sounded unique?
Well, it was something, I guess, when they spoke, as he came. I'm not sure how far Mr. Spielberg actually went into creating a whole language, but they had an episode on it once in which they all these little creatures went around, and they were kind of a menace to the rest of the cartoon characters.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure about that one and how much structure it has to it, but, you know, in the movies, there's often someone who speaks a strange language, like the Ewoks have a little language in Star Wars, but if you look closely at it, there really isn't a system there. It's sort of it sounds good, like what the Ewoks would say. But if you are a filmmaker and you want to help develop your fan base, you do yourself well by making a real system that people can dig into and try to learn, and you just might develop a little community of fans that way.
Let's go next to Rob in Carrollton. Hello, Rob.
Hi. I was wondering, I'm a computer science student, and I was wondering if she's ever looked at, your guest has ever looked at computing languages, like programming languages. They're designed syntactically to be unambiguous and to express a certain core set of concepts. I'm wondering if she's looked at them, or anyone has looked at them from a natural linguistic or, you know, a linguistic standpoint. Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks. Yeah, I don't deal specifically with programming languages because they are, you know, their reason for being is to give instructions to machines, and I'm more focused on languages intended for people to communicate with each other. But Loglan and Lojban, the logical language I discuss, putting together a sentence in one of those languages certainly feels like writing a line of code, and it's maybe an intermediate language between a true programming language and a natural spoken language. You have to be completely unambiguous. Every sentence has only one parse, it really has the feel of a programming language that you can actually speak and say. You can say things like, you know, you can talk about the world and your surroundings in a way that you can't necessarily do with a language designed to just transmit instructions.
Would you say that studying these invented languages revealed anything to you about the nature of natural language that hadn't been obvious before when you were simply working as a linguist?
Well, it gave me this deeper appreciation for the range of things that we do with natural languages. We can be very precise with natural languages. We have legal language and jargons and we have ways of making our language closer to this, you know, perfect logical rational end of the spectrum, but we can also go completely the other way and just blab on and on without much content and use that for social purposes or whatever purposes, and it's all part of the same language, this wide range of things that we do with it, and it really makes me appreciate just how flexible and wonderful natural languages are.
We have an email here from Jeremy who asks if you're familiar with Hopelandic, a language developed by the Icelandic band Sigur Rós.
I've heard of that. I believe it's more of a sound-based thing. I'm not sure it has a connection to, you know, you can sit down with it and figure out the grammar and what all the words mean. Like I said, I don't know much about it, but yes, I have heard of that.
Do the grammar structures of these languages tend to reflect the essential grammar of the languages that people spoke natively before they invented whatever it was they came up with?
Well, certainly the Esperanto-type languages reflect the European era of nationalism in which they grew up. Many of them, especially these new artistic ones, are consciously, the artist, if you will, is consciously trying to get away from the ruts of their own language. So make it as different and as strange and as unlike your native language as possible, and then you've really created something and done a little mind experiment with how far you can push away from your own native language.
Do you think it's possible that someone will come up with a new language out of whole cloth that people will really adopt, even to a greater extent than Esperanto?
I don't think so, but I'm sort of a natural skeptic about these things. And if you had, if I had been around in 1880s at the birth of Esperanto, I would have said, no way there will ever be native speakers of this language. And, yep, now there are. So, I probably would have been proved wrong then, but I'm still not willing to predict that this will ever be have a universal invented language.
Is George Soros a native speaker of Esperanto?
He's not a native speaker, but he learned it. His father was a very prominent Esperantist, and so he learned it early and used to be quite involved in the movement.
And in fact, changed the family name.
Yes, their name was Schwartz, and Soros means to will soar in Esperanto.
Do people who speak Esperanto natively, universally, also speak another language?
Yes, there are no monolingual native speakers of Esperanto, if two people who speak from different backgrounds and speak different languages meet at an Esperanto conference, get married and have children, and their only language in common with each other is Esperanto, then their kids will have it as their home native language. Of course, they'll also learn the language of the wider society around them. but they are, real native speakers of it.
Let's go next to Michaela in Arlington. Hey, Michaela.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I'm way far out of the Metroplex, so I might just lose the signal. I hope not. I teach Latin at high school, and one of the questions that my students always ask me is, why are there irregular verbs? Where do the irregularities come from? And I try to, come up with a number of explanations, none of which are really solid, because it just makes sense to me. Different pockets of people over that hillside spoke this language, and then there are, then they find each other, but they say things slightly differently, and so the verbs or nouns become irregular or defective or deponents and all these sorts of things, different formations of words. But I would rather have a more professional opinion on something like this so that I could give them a more authoritative explanation.
Erica, can you help her out?
Well, I'll try to in a short time, but language is really essentially a habit, a well-entrenched habit, a way of doing things. And it's always, always changing. That's sort of the banal but very important truth about all languages. They're always changing from generation to generation. But some things that are really well-entrenched as habits don't change. So when we say things like the verb to be, we use it all the time, over and over again, and therefore it's very resistant to changes that are going on around us in other parts of the language. So that's why the verb to be is so irregular in so many languages, because we're using it over and over again, we're entrenching those habits, and when other things change around it, to be doesn't change because we're just doing it so much. An irregularity is really just something that got left behind when the rest of the language changed.
Do you have a spiral notebook or a file on your computer somewhere where you've started creating Ocrentium or whatever sort of artificial language you might want to create?
I tried. I thought it would be interesting to set out to try to invent one myself, and I came up with lots of ideas that I thought were pretty clever. But when I met up with the conlangers and saw what they were doing, I realized that I didn't have that kind of follow-through. They're really dedicated to these projects, and it's not enough to have a cool idea. You have to really sit down and work out the details, and uh, I'm just I guess I'm too lazy for that part.
Well, just as a thought experiment, what would your language, if you were going to follow through, what would you want to make sure that it contained?
Well, some of the ideas I came up with were, what if you had a language where it was English words, but they all meant something different, or if you had a language where it was you actually had to eat the message and digest it in your digestive system in order to understand it, or, you know, sort of far out things like that. So if someone wants to use that, go ahead. I'm not going to work it out.
Do you have a favorite invented language?
It's hard for me to come up with one. I have a great affection for particular language inventors, I especially like the ones who were humble and modest in the way they talked about their languages, like Fukishi Okamoto, the inventor of Boabamu, who worked all his life in difficult circumstances to create this language of peace and harmony for the world. That never really went anywhere, but I got to admire him for his follow through.
Well, and it seems like humility was sort of a rare quality in these people.
Yeah, most language inventors do have dreams of being recognized as geniuses and winning the Nobel Prize and forgiving this marvelous invention to the world. But it usually doesn't work out that way.
I was also struck that a lot of them seem to have invented many things, not just linguistically, but they had a lot of different ideas for improving things around them.
Yeah, the urge to tinker and improve is often not limited to language. If you're a person who likes big, grand, sweeping ideas, you're probably going to like a lot of different varieties of them.
Are you still studying Klingon?
I haven't kept it up too well. I do have my Klingon dictionary on my iPhone, so if I ever run into a situation where I need to use it, I can use my dictionary Klingon.
And there are people who are willing to walk into a restaurant and try to order in Klingon.
Yes, that's at the conference. Some people there were very committed to only speaking Klingon the entire time, and this included when we were out in general public areas. They were foreigners in a strange land.
Erica Okrent is a linguist and a cognitive neuroscientist. Her new book is called In the Land of Invented Languages, Esperanto Rockstars, Klingon Poets, Logland Lovers, and the Mad Dreamers Who Tried to Build a Perfect Language. Erica, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.